Good morning and welcome to Our Times with Craig Barnes, and I am Craig Barnes, at least on this morning. And we have a most remarkable doctor to talk to this morning, somebody who thinks of medicine as a community activity, a teaching activity, a training for children activity, a training for doctors activity, a woman, Dr. Pamela Weibel, who is talking to us from Eugene, Oregon. Welcome, Dr. Weibel.
Thank you, Craig. Thanks for inviting me.
It's lovely. I've been reading excerpts from chapters that you've written for a book called The Goddess Shift, a chapter you've written called Love Uncontained. And then I've been reading proposals from your book called Doctoring for Democracy, One Community, One Doctor, and a Dream for America. Dr. Weibel, I will tell our listeners, has pioneered a way of creating a presence in the community for medicine, a presence for healing that is quite remarkable. We're going to talk about it today. One of the things that that you've said about your practice, which I'll ask you to say something about and how you got to this practice, but you say now, welcome to a sanctuary with 60-minute appointments and a complimentary massage. A safe place where nobody is turned away for lack of money. A place of wisdom right in the middle of the neighborhood where the doctor answers the phone and says, come right over, and is waiting for you when you arrive. It sounds like paradise on earth. How did you get to this point in your life where you could actually provide medicine in this way?
Well, I think I had to sink down into a state of intense despair. And from that, I had an epiphany. So I was just like any other doctor in this country in primary care, working very hard, trying to provide the best care for my patients, but unfortunately placed in an unsustainable situation in which I was essentially on a production line so that I literally was not allowed to care for my patients. There wasn't time to actually care. And so it's just a situation that creates burnout and definitely, you know, almost murders the soul of a physician placed in that position because I don't think any physician in this country wants to experience empathy burnout or not care about their patients. But due to the way healthcare has been set up in this country, it's literally impossible for most physicians to practice the way they want to. So I actually was dreaming of returning to my college waitressing job just so I could be nice to people again.
So you're talking about, you mentioned empathy burnout.
Mm-hmm.
And this, what is it, does the corporate practice require you to move a certain number of people through in a certain time? How does that work?
Actually, most practices, corporate or not, in this country have a production line model in which the emphasis is really how many patients you can see per day to pay for this exorbitant overhead, because unfortunately, I think in the United States, we're really enamored with this idea of bigger is better. So we have these sort of big box clinics, and people are trying to, you know, see as many patients as they can, and the person at the end of the day gets the trophy who's seen the most number of patients. This sort of it's almost like turning medicine into a competitive sport. And I just never really got into, I'm not somebody that's real motivated by finances, and I'm not interested in competing. High quality care and connect on an emotional, spiritual, and physical level with my patients and heal them.
You did the traditional practice for how many years?
Probably a decade or so. Yeah.
So you had 10 years to have empathy burnout.
Six jobs in 10 years.
Six jobs.
Yeah.
Trying one after the next because you thought something.
Yeah, I always thought maybe the grass would be greener somewhere else, but it was really all about the money everywhere. And I'm not blaming anyone. I just think we've fallen into a situation in which somehow money and the bottom line has taken over our humanity. You know, so we're unable, and especially in certain work situations, to relate to each other with love and compassion.
So rather than boxing out or sealing over this despair that you were feeling, or crusting it over, or getting yourself conditioned so that you didn't feel for your patient, you actually took the despair yourself and dropped out?
Yeah, I dropped out, and I got into bed for about 6 weeks and went into a really deep depression and was basically suicidal, really, because I always wanted to be a physician. That's what I believe I was born to do. And unfortunately, I was placed in an inhumane situation and expected to deliver health care, and it just wasn't working, and I couldn't find any other way of doing it, so I just fell into an extreme depression.
So the industry line, assembly line system was driving you nuts.
Pretty much.
And at the end of the 6 weeks, what did you do?
Well, I had an epiphany on Pearl Harbor Day in 2004 at about 6 in the morning. I really felt like I was jolted out of bed by this amazing vision of how healthcare could be in this country. It didn't have to be a struggle. It didn't have to be like a tug of war with adversarial relationships between doctors and physicians rushing through exam rooms. We could actually allow the patients and the community to design their ideal medical practice. I just thought, wow, I could lead like a town hall meeting and ask my community, who are as dissatisfied as I was about healthcare, ask them to design their ideal practice, like their fantasy medical clinic, and I would work there. I thought it was a great idea, and it worked.
And so you had what, meetings with over a period of
how
long? Yeah,
over a period of time. I actually started on January 20th, 2005, the first day of George Bush's second term, and then continued through the 6th of March. I had several meetings, I think maybe 9, and in the end I collected over 100 pages of written testimony, and that became my business plan, and we were open 1 month later.
Well, people told you we would like, is that where you got the idea for a massage in
yeah,
your waiting room?
Yeah,
people
said,
I want to go see the doctor, I want to have a massage first.
Yeah, I got all my ideas from most of my ideas. They had some great, fantastic. This town is full of very creative people.
And you're talking about Eugene, Oregon, right?
Yeah, Eugene, Oregon. So when you ask them to come up with solutions for big time national problems, there's no lack of solutions. It's just that I think most people at the grassroots level don't feel like their voice is being heard. So I think the difference is that I, as a physician, wanted to hear their voice, which they couldn't believe. I think some people were floored by it. I actually heard from a woman later who didn't come to the meeting because she thought it was too good to be true. She just actually couldn't even put her head around the idea that a doctor would actually listen to the community and create a practice like this.
So you have sofas in your waiting room, and you have massages, and you have a kind of a comfortable environment, and then you're able to actually give people 60-minute appointments.
Yeah.
And you answer the phone yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do that.
I know that. I called you the other day, and you said, hello.
I know. It is sort of startling. A lot of other physicians are doing what I'm doing around the country. And when I call their offices and they answer the phone, I'm still startled. You know, it's hard for me to believe that I can reach other doctors.
Well, all of us want to know, how in the world can you give 60-minute appointments, allow people to have a massage? I'm really on my way to Eugene, I think, for my next appointment. But how can you give a 60-minute appointment? Oh, whatever. I'm sure it's not by road either. It's what's required, whatever works or is necessary. But how do you do that, answer the phone yourself, and stay available so you can say to people, come on over?
Well, I think the big thing I do, and I must clarify, not everyone's getting complimentary massages. I did that a few days where I hired a massage therapist to massage patients who I felt like it would be patients who had never had a massage before, like Medicaid patients, patients who are poor that would never be able to afford a massage. I had a lot of my high-need psychiatric patients come on one day, and I hired a massage therapist for that day because I'm trying to think of, gee, what is it that I can actually do for somebody? What do they really need? I mean, most people don't really need a prescription. The root of their problem is something a little deeper than that. So I sit and I think, what is it that I can facilitate happening for this human being sitting in front of me that would be the most therapeutic thing for them? And sometimes, amazingly enough, it's just receiving safe, loving touch from someone else which they've never experienced before in their life. You know, that could be transformative.
It does sound that. I'm impressed. You described a situation in which you were visiting, in one of your writings, you described a situation you're visiting with a patient who has a foot problem, and the two of you, you're about to examine her foot, and the two of you fall into telling stories and laughing. And
you know, we were laughing the whole time. It was like a slumber party. I mean, literally, this woman's foot was like an inch from my nose, her bare foot. You know, I had taken the sock off, her sock off, and there was like, you know, lint between her toes. And I was laughing so hard, I almost inhaled her sock lint. And then by the end of the visit, you know, she left and everything's wonderful. I'm sitting down to, you know, sort of compile my thoughts and fill out her chart note. And I realized it was just shocking to me that I never examined her foot. So I was having so much fun with her, I forgot, even though her naked foot was in my face. And I did call her just as soon as I could to offer her a free appointment, you know, to come back because I was just so embarrassed. That was the only reason she came in, was for her foot pain. And she told me as soon as she left the office, it had disappeared.
So as you've just said, doctoring is in some way much wider than doing prescriptions. It's falling in love with the community. It's engaging in a kind of a deep listening to people who are with you for that time, feeling, you've said sometimes, curing loneliness, just being in a place where they are listened to, maybe healing as well.
Yeah, some people have said they have never experienced that. You know, they come to the office, there's no beeping or buzzing or fax machines, because I have all of that at my home business office. All my administrative tasks I handle in a completely separate location. So when I go to my actual office where I see patients, it's just, you know, the futon, the beautiful carpet, the wall hangings, you know, my little wicker chair and the exam table. And it's a very relaxing living room looking place, you know. Of course, around the little pony wall, you can have all the regular medical equipment is there that I need. But nothing is scary looking, no sharp metal instruments, you know, sort of sitting out, you know, when you walk in the door. And so some people say when they're sitting on that futon that they actually feel well just sitting there. Just because they haven't spent any time in the last day or week sitting in silence. So just the act of coming to the office and experiencing the just sweet solitude of just hearing their own breathing and not rushing around and playing with their gadgets, their cell phones. I mean, just that in itself apparently is therapeutic. And some people don't even have that level of listening, you know, with their own spouse.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And you say as well that you create an environment which is safe, and but also an environment in which teaching is a major part. And teaching leads to people taking better care of themselves. How does that work?
Well, I'm trying my best to be a role model. So a lot of people, when they come to see me, it's one of their first times seeing, if not the first time seeing, a doctor who's happy. So just seeing another human being who's living their dream and a happy, self-employed person, I think they start to grapple with some ideas like maybe they don't have to keep their job that is dissatisfying for them. Maybe they deserve something better in life. Because seriously, as a physician that was burned out and really depressed and unable to connect with my patients, I was really giving the message to people that, you know, they were thinking, well, if my doctor can't figure it out and looks burned out and exhausted, maybe I don't deserve anything better either, you know? So I'm modeling happiness and joy. Maybe.
And there's an incentive system built in, which is a teaching system. You said that sometimes you offer rewards for good conduct.
Yeah,
you have a gift basket. What's that?
Well, the gift basket is full of local handmade items, soaps and lotions and, you know, body care products and inspirational books and things that I think would be, you know, related to health. And, you know, basically everything in there is about $5 in value. But, you know, I have a collection, and then people come in now when they've ridden their bike to the office or walked or taken the bus or done something that shows that they're you know, trying to be environmental and healthy. And, you know, they get a gift automatically from the gift box. They can pick something. And so I at times looked out of my one-way mirror in my door and seen a patient, you know, a lot of them have lined up in little bike helmets. It's just really cute to see patients coming in with their bicycle helmets.
So you're and, and you've mentioned that an obese woman gets free office visits for 2 years if she does what?
Yeah, well, so she has no money, and her sister brought her to me because she thought I was her only chance of, like, her savior or something. That she, you know, because, of course, she couldn't find any other doctor. She has no money. And, you know, when you go to community health centers or other clinics, you just get sped through, you know, at a fast rate. And she wanted her sister to connect with me and to heal from some major trauma, domestic abuse, and all sorts of diabetes and high blood pressure and obesity. You know, she had the full range of problems. And so I don't like to make healthcare a passive experience. I really feel like patients should contribute something, not just sort of come begging for a prescription. So since there was no way this woman could pay anyway, I just thought, well, if you lose 4 pounds a month, you could come for free until you get to your ideal body weight, which basically would have been about 2 years of visits or more. And she did it for a while. She did it for a few months, and she was losing 4 pounds a month and doing that for me. And she'd actually had a breakdown one day and started crying because she couldn't believe I cared that much. That's another thing. People get moved to the point of they really just can't stand it because they haven't had anyone really care about them that much. And so I think that pushes some people over the edge for a time. But she ended up moving to another town after a while, so I actually don't know how she's doing at this moment, though I still see her sister.
Yeah, and as a teacher, do you actually teach by more than example? Is there can you help people with diet and exercise and things like that? Do you have time to encourage them into that? You said they'd come to the clinic on bicycles. Do they? What does the teaching involve in addition?
Well,
to
I've actually prescribed people like a lot of my patients will not want to go on pharmaceutical medicine for their blood pressure. So I say, well, we've got to do something. What do you want to do? And I think at many other offices, when I was so busy, we just sort of say, okay, try lifestyle. Good luck, you know. And that's very nebulous. Like there's no real. We didn't shake our hand and agree to any sort of plan. Just sort of the try lifestyle plan. So now I make them agree to something very specific. If they want to try lifestyle, I have recipes, and they can pick which one they want to try that would be good for lowering blood pressure. You know, basically, the one of them is a kale smoothie. It's like a green drink. It's actually very delicious. I know it sounds sort of disgusting, but it is really delicious. It's just a fruit smoothie with a few leaves of kale. You could use spinach if you want instead of kale. But, you know, essentially...
What's the alternative to that? Is there some... Tell me quick. What's the alternative?
It's really delicious. People love them. They get addicted to them. The thing is, then I have different soups they could try or hibiscus tea. But basically, they decide, you know, which appeals to them, and they replace one meal a day. I mean, most of them like the kale smoothie. They replace one meal a day with a smoothie. And they lose weight and their blood pressure goes down.
So, and you also take these programs into the schools, I think.
Oh, I did that during residency. I went to the schools. I haven't done that recently, but it was so much fun. I took all different fruits and vegetables in one of the areas where I think people had never seen fruits and vegetables. And we sat there and played games with them, and everyone got to taste them, and they got really excited. And I got 100 letters from fourth graders one day back in the mail that said, oh, how much they love fruits and vegetables. They promised me they were going to eat fruits and vegetables the rest of their life. And I think a lot of it is just kids and people in general having access to healthy lifestyle, like living in a neighborhood where it's not so crime-ridden, they can actually go outside and walk and bike, or living in a place where they actually have a grocery store nearby, not just one of those, you know, 7-Elevens with, you know, 3 for $1 high fructose corn syrup snacks. So, you know, a lot of people are living in some very odd situations in this country where they don't have access to healthy foods or a healthy living environment. And then when they come down with diabetes at age 30, you know, they're suddenly blamed, and they're, of course, uninsured because they didn't have access to a job either. So I just think we need to change the way we relate to to people.
I'm going to come back to you with a very serious and critical question. But first, we have to take a short break. You're listening to Our Times with Craig Barnes, and our guest today is Dr. Pamela Weibel. We'll take a break. So, Dr. Weibel, this is all well and good. You're teaching children. What can you say to an older fella, somebody I might know, who really likes meat and potatoes? Do you have a nice way to combine the sofa and the massage and the careful, thoughtful? How do you deal with old people who are really set in their ways?
Well, I don't know. Some people who are set in their ways like that and can smoke their whole life and live to age 95 and don't seem to have a problem. So I'm not necessarily trying to get everyone to follow what I'm doing. I just look at their, again, it's not a one-size-fits-all scenario. If that particular person was obese and had high cholesterol.
This particular person is not actually obese or high cholesterol that I'm thinking of. Actually quite healthy on the whole, but still likes meat and potatoes. Is there some way to move one off of that?
Oh, well, if you would like to move off of meat and potatoes, I guess the thing to look at is his cholesterol is not high, he's not obese, not having other problems, he might want to get onto a diet that has more fruits and vegetables just to prevent cancer, which is the number one cause of death in the country. So, because they're, of course, full of antioxidants. And so one way that I sometimes explain this to people is I say, well, you don't really have to give up anything. Just look at animal products as condiments, you can have more of a plant-based meal, but you could still use, do a stir fry, and instead of having like a lot of chicken in there, just have a little bit to season it, for example. So.
Well, okay. If I see this fella, meet him on the street, I'll pass that advice along.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. whatever works, really.
Well, I'll combine your advice with my wife's advice, which is very similar. And I guess the two of you will probably get me into the, I hope, will get me, turn me a corner. Turn to the critical issue of how you can maintain a people-friendly clinic, a relationship-based clinic rather than an assembly line clinic, how you can have longer appointments, how you can do all of that with great care and obvious results, and how does it pay for itself?
Okay. Well, the one thing I wanted to mention before is one key issue that I've tried to embrace in this practice is not overworking myself, so I don't take any more patients than I can handle, right? So right now I have about 420 patients, and I work part-time. So maybe if I worked full-time, I'd have 1,000 patients. The average doctor in this country in primary care has maybe 2,000 patients. So see, I personally don't feel like I could do a good job with 2,000 patients. It would be like if I had 35 children. I'd probably be a really bad parent. I'd probably do better with 2 or 3. And so it's the kind of thing where I'm trying not to bite off more than I can chew so I can, provide good service to everyone who I see. And so you were asking a financial question, how does this pay for itself?
Yes.
Well, I think the biggest thing that's of assistance is that my overhead is no longer 74%. In some of these larger offices, I had a friend whose overhead was 85%. That means if you get $100 for treating somebody for bronchitis, you really earn like 15.
All of that overhead is doing what? It's maintaining staff.
Paying for all these staff people that are running in circles around you, many of which are just causing more confusion and chaos and they're definitely creating an ambiance of anxiety. When a patient comes in and there's people running up and down the halls and faxes beeping and papers flying and doctors rushing down, it doesn't create the ambiance that people described in the public testimony I received. So I'm just trying to follow, again, I'm just providing a service that's requested of me by my community, And as a result of removing the middleman and a lot of unnecessary third-party interference and having a smaller office, my office is only 280 square feet versus an entire city block that some medical clinics, you know, take up. And so I really did have a very low electricity bill and very low rent. So because of the lower expenses, I can earn more of everything, all the revenue that the practice receives.
And you you don't take Visa, MasterCard, or American Express?
No, I don't. But I trade with people.
What do they bring?
I have a guy doing work for me today. He's a carpenter, and he came for a visit that he couldn't afford it. So he's working in my house for a while.
And sometimes, bread and jam?
Oh, yeah. People give me all sorts of things, handmade organic children's clothing and carrot juice and home-baked bread and homegrown produce and all different sorts of things and services and, yeah. So they'll pretty much try anything.
And when you get handmade organic children's clothing, what do you do with it?
Well, they're too small for the child I'm getting ready to adopt. He's 16 and 6'4" and wears 16 shoes. So I send them to my relatives who have little babies.
And you're finding time to adopt a 16-year-old?
Yeah, 16-year-old beautiful boy.
Mm-hmm. Magnificent.
Yeah, this summer he'll be here.
So you're expanding your life. You are not just in your clinic all the time. You're having actual life that gives you some happiness.
I actually have a life too, which is
This is great. Are you able to say of yourself, who can say this, I suppose, but there's the implication that you are, in fact, happy.
Yeah, I'm definitely happy. I'm happier than I ever have been, and this is the longest I've ever kept a job in my life. I've never been at a job more than a year and a half, and I've been here 4.5 years, so it's working.
So you don't take Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. You do take chickens and bread loaves and children's clothing.
Uh-huh. I trade for massage. You know, I have a lot of massage therapy clients that are massage therapists.
So you get a lot of massage. So no wonder you're feeling good.
Yeah, that helps me feel great.
And it doesn't sound like you do business with the health insurers.
I do.
You
I
do.
Accept insurance. Yeah, 80% of my patients have health insurance. So I pretty much do whatever works. Mm-hmm. The only thing is certain insurance companies, a rare few, are very hard to deal with because the administrative burden is out of hand or they're disrespectful to people and that you call 1-800-HELP and nobody answers or they send you to India. And so there's certain insurance companies that I don't do business with. But most of the local ones that my patients have, I accept, and I bill through a free online clearinghouse. So, yeah, it's really great because patients can come to me and have the experience as far as billing that they would have at any other office. You know, I do the billing.
You do the billing, and and you do the examination, and do the nursing component as well.
And I give out the prizes and the balloons, and I clean my office, and
And you're in relationship with these. How do you stay in relationship?
Yeah, I don't want to miss anything. It's like a parent who loves a child. You don't want to miss any little step. I want to be there the whole way through.
Well, let me shine some light or some question, maybe it's darkness, into this. I used to practice law years ago, and I had a very difficult time maintaining 15 or 20 cases. Now, some lawyers do 200 like you suggest, or you don't suggest that, but some lawyers can carry out. I had a very difficult time in part because at the core of my satisfaction as a lawyer was just something you've described, was the relationship with the client, was digging into the life and being ethically correct and hopeful and able to use the system to save somebody's whatever it was, financial situation or whatever. But that I found it very difficult to extend beyond a rather small number compared to yours. 300 or 400 is still quite a few, isn't it?
420 patients.
Yes. You still have your work cut out for you maintaining this relationship, or a relationship, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I think when these people, maybe it's a little different than law. I'm not sure.
It's a
but
lot
when
different
patients,
than law.
Yeah,
for sure.
It probably is. But when patients come in for an hour-long visit and you answer their last 10 years of questions that they've never been able to get answers for, mm-hmm. and you really dig to the root of their problem, you know, like I have a 50-year-old woman who has insomnia, but, you know, this is caused by a sexual abuse when she was 6 years old. So there's not really anything that I can do, even in an hour-long visit, that would solve that. But I refer her to a really excellent therapist who's sort of like a medical intuitive in town, and she actually was able to resolve some of these really deep-seated issues. So I don't just sort of glaze over the surface and here take the sleeping pill. I like get to the bottom of why people can't sleep. You know,
and if I remember.
When I do that, the reason they don't have to come back as much. You know, some patients, they don't even come back for a year or two because I've answered all their backlog of questions and issues. They have nothing to come back for.
That's great, and you may even take a patient to another therapist or go with.
Yes,
her or
I attend these therapy sessions with my patients. You know, the ones that have the really. You know, one woman came in for her physical. You know, that was relatively simple to do, pap smear and all of that, but she cried the entire time because her mother just died and she really missed her mom. So really, the most significant issue that I could help her with was her grief around her mother's death. So we went together the next week to this therapist, and she was also having dreams about her mother that she could not interpret, and she felt like she wanted to try to understand, you know, if her mother was trying to somehow communicate with her from the afterworld, you know. So I took her to this therapist where she could really dive into some of these issues that I'm not completely skilled at, you know. And so we did that together, and that was really productive. So, yeah.
And then you don't turn people away because in advance they are announced they don't have insurance, or you what do? You say, well, have you got a chicken?
Oh, no, I do whatever makes sense, you know. So sometimes I have them donate items to the community gift basket that I told you about.
That's terrific, yeah.
Like, yeah one woman is a glass fuser, and she teaches classes, and people can make their own plates and all different things for their home at her, you know, she has a kiln. So she donated, like, a several-hour class for somebody into this gift basket so that, like, the next patient who rides their bike to the office can get a free glass fusion class or something.
One of the things that is terribly difficult to treat that affects people's standard medical care, one of the situations is addiction. Mm-hmm. A person may come in and have the immediate cause of the accident or the liver problem worked on, but the bigger problem is this overriding mental state that, or whatever it is that creates addiction. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that part? Which let me just say a little more, that a person can be really out of his or her own control, can be under the influence of whatever the addictive problem is, and actually living at two levels: one, this is what I'm doing today, and another, under the control of the demon that is within. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that double personality problem when you meet addiction? Or do you fight? Yeah, I guess you do. If you have these long interviews with people, long conversations, you probably become aware of that at some point, do you not?
Oh, yeah. There are people, a lot of people addicted to tobacco and then, you know, alcohol, most common. And then, you know, pain medication. There are people that come in on massive amounts of pain medicine that won't want me to refill. And, you know, I explain to them my philosophy, which is, you know, maybe the pain in your life is coming from somewhere else that we can address without drugs, without as much drugs. And so this woman that's on a pretty massive amount of pain medicines who came to me to switch to have me as her physician, when I got down to the bottom of her issue, and yes, she has physical ailments that would certainly cause pain, and you know, but the level of pain medicine she's on, and I was giving her all these options, you know, here are some things that we can do, and she was really downplaying the potential success of anything that I was saying, and come to find out that she finally reveals that she's extremely cynical, and she's, you know, completely disappointed with her life. and trying to ask her more about the cynicism, you know, because that's not going to work with any treatment I recommend. If I recommend a treatment, even as an optimistic doctor full of inspiration, and the person looks at me with a blank face with, like, you know, a problem with cynicism, you know, nothing I suggest is going to work. And she finally admitted to me that basically everyone in her family is cynical. I finally had to write it down in her family history. Part of her chart is like cynicism, everyone in the family. And so we're actually dealing with that, you know? And the way I deal with that, well, first it helps for people to realize they're actually suffering from a mental condition called cynicism, you know, which is, you know, changing the way their success and life in lots of areas, career, personal life, you know, physical. And so I ask people sometimes to write a vision statement for their life or try to tap into what their purpose is, what their soul's purpose is here, because a lot of people lack meaning in their life. And so they're trying to escape all the time from a life that they're living that they don't want to be living. That's because they have not accessed the true meaning of who they are or their true destiny. So I try to help people, you know, become in alignment with their own purpose, with their own soul. I think when people do that, they manage to get a lot more energy, their fibromyalgia goes away, and they require less pain medicine.
Well, clearly, this is a place where your clinic is a place where people get a wide range of things that that may not be, or certainly are not available in most doctors' offices, and may not be accessible to most doctors, because this requires a kind of comprehensive or a small C Catholic competence and ability to reach into the soul, as you describe it, and provide some support there, some empathy, some compassion. That's not an easy skill to come by, those skills, the teaching skills, the compassion skills, the relationship skills, the ability to, the creativity to say, if you can't go to that thyroid specialist by yourself, I'll go with you. That range, is this model that you're developing transferable, or does it require Dr. Pamela Weibel?
No, it's completely reproducible, and it's been done around the country. I don't know that everyone has done it with the town hall meeting approach, but, you know, getting back to the neighborhood physician, the moving slower, the longer appointments. There's a map on my website with hundreds of doctors doing this all around the country.
Hundreds of doctors?
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds
yeah.
of doctors doing this.
Hundreds of doctors, yeah.
Following their own heart.
Right.
Men and women, right?
Men and women, right.
Not just women, men and women.
No, men and women, right. Yeah. And wonderful people. You should go check that out. If anyone is looking for a doctor in their area, they can.
And how do you check that out? What do you look for?
It's on the idealmedicalpractice.org website, which is my website, idealmedicalpractice.org. And if they click on create your own clinic, or there's a little tab there, and the very first hyperlink on that section, let's see, I'll just create your own clinic. The very first section, it says find an ideal clinic near you. And if they click on that, then they can see this very huge map, and they can just move around and click on their area and find doctors nearby who are doing the old-fashioned Marcus Welby, you know, neighborhood approach.
And the website again is?
idealmedicalpractice.org.
Well, all right. All right. So you're not the only one. It is reproducible.
No, and I think other physicians would want to do this. Unfortunately, they're placed in work situations that make it unsustainable, and they've been bred out of their compassion. Medical training, at least what I went through in medical school, we were forced to do things that were unethical and that made it less likely for us to keep our morals and connect with our own souls. So, of course, if you're disconnected emotionally and spiritually with yourself, it will be harder to connect emotionally and spiritually with a patient.
You're saying that in medical school you were required to do things that were unethical?
Mm-hmm.
In what sense?
Well, in my medical school, we had to do dog labs, murder four innocent dogs to graduate, dogs that did nothing wrong other than be in the pound at the wrong time, I guess, previous pets, that we actually had to give heart attacks and do all sorts of, like, experiments on. And they actually, when I protested this, and I was the first person in my class to graduate without having to kill animals, and they diagnosed me with the Bambi syndrome. They sort of made fun of me for caring. it was sort of uncool to care too much, okay? So you can imagine that environment in medical school. And so...
Pamela, we're going to take a short break here.
Okay.
You're listening to Our Times with Craig Barnes, and we're talking to Dr. Pamela Weibel from Eugene, Oregon, about the most unorthodox and yet profoundly orthodox kind of medical care available. And we'll be right back. And we are back, and we were talking about the unethical confrontations that might happen in a medical practice. Not only you talked about just now about having to kill dogs and dogs that had in no way earned that sentence, I want to pursue that dark side a little more, because you've said in your proposal for your book, Doctoring for Democracy, that there is an underground world of mafioso bribes and criminality, a world where drug reps have sex with doctors, and that's all a part of the underlying condition in American practice today. Is there anything you can share about your escapades with pharmaceutical company people or how that all works?
Well, I mean, you take somebody who's exhausted after a long day of work and have these smiling drug reps come in. Many of them were previous cheerleaders, you know. They actually choose from the cheerleaders. It's amazing. So you have these very attractive women who are bouncing around the office, like giving you all sorts of fun treats, like, like I went into my office and looked like Halloween on my desk. I had all these, Reese's peanut butter cups and teddy bears, and, you know, they're constantly giving you things and then inviting you to ski trips for the weekend. And I got to go on a cruise, just through the Lake Washington locally in Seattle with courtesy of an antidepressant drug. I got to go because of a migraine drug on a big murder mystery dinner train ride somewhere, to a vineyard. It's just really amazing what I've been offered. And I sort of go as like an undercover investigative journalist because I really can't believe what goes on. And so, yeah, I took some mental notes. I found it pretty amazing how they're spending money to influence doctors' prescribing habits. And then a lot of the more egregious behavior has been banned, you know, like giving trips to Hawaii and that sort of thing. I think things were really out of control in the 80s and 70s. But anyway, they still can do several things like these cruises and such and restaurant dinners and all of that. And actually, a relative of mine was a drug rep. And she told me, I had no idea, but she told me that in some of these larger cities that drug reps, because they're no longer able to influence doctors with really big gifts, are actually, some of them are having sex with doctors.
Well, I suppose if Tiger Woods can be enchanted that way, others can as well. It's not...
Uh-huh.
Not,
but then, you know, it's just, it's really...
It's a way of selling
bad.
Your product. Yeah, it's very,
because,
it's bad, yes.
You know, like Tiger Woods, that's one thing, but these people, you're going into exam room and they've got your life in their hands, and they're possibly giving you something that's not the best medicine for you that might have bad side effects like liver failure, but because they just had sex with a drug rep or went on a big trip, like... You know, this is endangering other people's lives and increasing the cost of health care.
Great
because
point.
These drugs are not cheap, or people wouldn't be prostituting themselves to get you to prescribe it. And then they also, pharmaceutical companies can track prescribing habits of doctors. You know, they get printouts from the pharmacy so they can see who's playing, you know, who ends up after, I guess, sex actually prescribing it. So they know who to go back to, I guess, you know, with the gifts and the trinkets and all of that.
It's a great and sad point. Yes,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
We're also aware during this season of this great national conversation about healthcare reform, of the enormous amounts of money that are being spent by the healthcare industry, $1.4 million a day in the first part of 2009, in order to lobby the Congress, in order to prevent changes in the system, so that these massive amounts of money and these networks of reps that are out influencing the doctors at the same time are all part of a tendency in the country toward
towards being bribed.
Bribed and concentrations of wealth that gradually remove doctoring from democratic practice. Just to return to your title, that that the more and more concentrated the wealth is in the healthcare industry, in the hospital industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, the more and more concentrated the wealth is there, the less and less it facilitates the kind of practice that you're describing, the less and less it encourages it, or and in fact, it must create a it must be behind the incentive for the assembly line practice, that that to some extent, substantial, maybe you would comment on this, but to some substantial degree, the medical practice has been turned into a financial machine rather than a caring effort. And that's part of what you're up against, I would say.
Yeah, I think just because there's all these third parties and they have all their regulations and rules, you have to hire extra staff to make sure you're not breaking any rules so that you don't go to jail for fraud by accident. So you have to have, you know, a lot of doctors just, you know, hire more and more staff to sort of protect them from all of these rules and regulations. And then because their revenue is not as high, you know, they're always told in journals and such that, you know, bigger is better. So hire more staff, see more patients per day, and you end up having less and less time with your patients because you're spending more and more time doing things that have nothing to do with healthcare. And, yeah, it's just, it's a sad situation. And I think the whole idea that we have a drug for every problem, and these are normal, you know, maybe people do need to feel sad because, for example, it is sad right now to witness a lot of things that are going on in the world. So maybe the solution isn't an antidepressant, but maybe actually feeling our pain so that we can move through it collectively. But because everyone, it's so easy to give them a pain medicine, I mean, a you know, psychiatric medicine, and leave the room in 5 minutes. It actually facilitates this assembly line style of care, which really is suppressing emotions that people need to feel, you know, normal emotions.
Right. Dr. Atul Gawande has written extensively in The New Yorker about the tendency in American medicine to over-test, for doctors to prescribe testing of one test on top of another test, to and in effect driving up healthcare costs in America way out of reach, because it is said on the one hand, well that's what we have to do in order to prevent malpractice, but is there some other psychological driver behind these tests, or is it maybe in a third alternative, is it simply a way to make more money? What is your opinion about all that testing?
Oh, I don't think it's a way to make more money because most doctors aren't getting kickbacks or anything or making more money from ordering tests. I think that a lot of it is defensive medicine because most doctors feel like, especially in emergency rooms, they feel like, wow, they'll never see this patient again. If they don't order all the tests now and something bad happens, they'll get sued and, you know, and that'll be just a huge crisis for them. So they try to, they just, and also we're assuming that sort of everyone's an adversary until proven otherwise, you know? So it creates this strange situation where we're trying to protect
Who assumes everybody's...
Oh, a lot of doctors are assuming the patients are either lying, especially in the emergency room, and you know, where you don't have a continuity with the patient. You know, I know all my patients, and a lot of family doctors know all their patients. They've seen them for 20 years, even though it's short visits. They've seen them over time. And so, you know, but a lot of times in urgent cares or emergency rooms, you know, doctors are more likely to order every possible test because they feel like this is their only opportunity to see this patient. And they, you know, they want a diagnosis right then and there. But I think another thing that drives this ordering excessive tests is because you're in such a short visit. First, two things. I think a lot of doctors would feel like they didn't do anything if all they did was hold the patient's hand and pat them on the back and tell them everything will be okay. That just doesn't seem like, I don't know, like you've accomplished anything.
I can understand that. It's quite, you know, human, like, actually. You'd want to have,
like,
all...
Yeah, like, here, have this pill or take this test and we'll get to the bottom of it. That just sounds, I don't know, braver or more heroic or something than you'll be okay, let me give you a hug, you know? So I think that plays into it. And also, doctors over time have become so robotic because they've just been again, detached from their own emotions and spiritual core, and they're unable to bond with other people who really, when they come to a physician, are seeking that in part, if not in whole, seeking that human connection. So because they no longer can access that part of themselves, they're sort of doing whatever they can, and they're really good at writing prescriptions and ordering tests, and that's easier, and you don't have to get your hands dirty.
Yes,
you know,
right,
you just,
right.
You know, so it's sort of like the easy way out of dealing with human emotions. You know, many physicians, just picture, you know, I know a lot of older male physicians who are like in their maybe 60s. They love their patients. They love what they're doing. But to tell you the truth, I can't imagine several of them wanting to sit in a room with a woman during menopause who's crying about her sex life going downhill. You know what I'm saying? Like, some doctors really don't want to. They would be uncomfortable listening to somebody
I can understand that
cry and talk about certain subjects. It's easier to just say, take this pill.
I can understand that. Let me ask you, I can understand that completely, actually.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's quite a human reaction, or at least a male human reaction.
Uh-huh.
I think that would be quite possible.
Uh-huh.
So your website is idealmedicalpractice.org. And you've been describing a practice that sounds as if it were almost ideal. What do you do when the patient is not in fact ideal, but is manipulative and perhaps deceptive? Do you fire patients?
Oh, yes. Very rarely I fired patients. And it's mostly, you know, like forged prescriptions or blatant lying or, you know, some people who over and over again I've asked them to do very simple things that would help themselves, and they're unwilling to do them. One man who has an anger problem, who every time would come in and sort of rage, but I'm really not the source of his anger, and I wanted him to go to counseling, and he wouldn't go over and over again. I stayed with him at my own detriment several visits and then realized, you know, I really don't deserve to be, and he wasn't really necessarily angry at me, but I was feeling the brunt of the anger and his loud voice and all of that, you know, and so I just told him it wasn't a match, you know. I really couldn't handle that degree of anger, and he needed to process that with a professional.
Dr. Pamela Weibel in Eugene, Oregon. Pamela, much of what we've been talking about, much of your reaction to this assembly line medicine feels to me like an approach that I'm familiar with in writing I've done.
I love your writing, by the way. I took notes. I have sticky pages all over, sticky, you know, those little sticky notes all over your book. So thank you.
We're referring to a book called In Search of the Lost Feminine, which traces the collision of women-centered cultures in early 1500 BCE, way back when the patriarchy began to establish its roots, and the myths that confirmed and reinforced patriarchy as the Greeks and the Semitic cultures in the Middle East built walls against this intuitive, regenerative, sensitive to the seasons, sensitive to relationships approach to life. And the patriarchal norms that arose out of that period way back a millennia before the Common Era, the patriarchal approach that until about the middle of the 19th century kept women out of away from being doctors completely, made it very difficult for them to be nurses, and only in the last 150 years have we begun to experience the surge of the feminine compassion, relationship building, caring into the field of medicine. When I was trying a lawsuit on behalf of nurses in Denver some years ago, the Colorado statute said that doctors would be analytical and nurses would be caring or nurturing, and that was my definition for females and males. That was the definition. So how we have just a couple of minutes left, but how does the whole idea of the larger sense of what we mean by the feminine in your medical practice feel to you? Are you doing a feminine in the larger sense reemergence in modern medicine?
Yeah, well, the main issue is I'm not afraid to love my patients and to express my love openly with them, to hug them, to kiss them, and I mean with boundaries, of course. I'm not sexually involved with my patients, but I am, you know, embracing them in a nurturing, almost maternal friendship sort of role, which is something that they wrote in their testimony. People wanted a doctor that was more like a friend that they could go to. And what's interesting is when I talk about this, and some male physicians, you know, wonder about what I'm doing, and some of the ones that are a little bit more challenging of me, you know, they want to see the graphs and the charts and what proves, you know, they want to see my proof that what I'm doing is working. And it's really hard to explain that, you know, when a patient leaves with tears in their eyes and tells me that was the best appointment they ever had with a doctor in their life, an elderly woman, you know, I just don't know how I could prove that on a chart or a graph. You know, what I'm doing is really beyond charting and graphing.
Well, and if you have to call a patient who's gotten home and say, I forgot to look at your foot, and she says, well, it's all right now, doctor. Well, something's working, I think.
Right. And so what's really colliding here, I think what I'm doing, especially because I'd like to mention this at the end, I've changed the whole question in healthcare to, you know, I like that part of your book where you say we need a new story, another story, you know, to represent, like, the real history. And I have this question, the statement really, which I feel those who design our questions have the power to shape our destiny.
Absolutely.
And
great,
right
great.
Now, you know, right now people are asking the question, you know, who's going to pay for all this? But that is absolutely the wrong question in healthcare. The first question is, what do we want? You know, what's the ideal? And so what I'm really colliding with more than anything else is this culture of cynicism that's just it's just everywhere in this country, you know, especially among many doctors. And so, that's our biggest problem, I would think.
Well, that's a fabulous report. Dr. Pamela Weibel, Eugene, Oregon, who runs the Ideal Medical Practice website, idealmedicalpractice.org. And you have been listening to Our Times with Craig Barnes. I will be back at this hour next week. And until then, may the wind be at your back. Look for democracy wherever you find it, and remember that after the winter comes the spring, always, every time.